This is the Music Publishing Podcast with your host, Dennis Tobenski. Join Dennis in his weekly nuts and bolts conversations with composers, performers, and other arts professionals as they navigate their careers as concert musicians in the 21st century. And now your host, Dennis Tobenski.
Hello, and welcome to the Music Publishing Podcast. I'm here today with two repeat guests who just met each other remotely for the first time about 10 minutes ago. Guest number one of the show, from episode one, Alex Shapiro. Alex, welcome.
Hello there.
And
happy to be back.
Oh, yeah, I'm so glad you're here. And the wonderful mezzo from last fall, Megan Enan. Megan, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so excited to do this.
Yeah. So today, I figure we'll dispense with introductions. You know, people can either they know you or they can listen to your earlier episodes.
Well, they could be thankful that they don't know us.
Yeah. So, quick reminder: Alex is an amazing composer. Lives out on San Juan Island off the coast of Washington. Washington.
Yep.
Yeah. Those two states up there, I'm like, which one's which? And Megan, excellent new music mezzo-soprano from Des Moines. So today we're going to talk a bit about commissioning, how that works. Megan and I were talking a little while ago about, you know, commissioning, how does it happen? What are different ways that it can happen? And I figured it'd be cool to have Megan as sort of a co-host today, and we can grill Alex and get the two sides of the equation, the performer and the composer, get all this stuff going. So, commissioning.
Yes.
Well,
I think the reason
thoughts.
We started having this conversation, Dennis, is because I had put out, you know, on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, saying, you know, I have this trio, we're actively commissioning, and I need to know more about it. And I said, who do you know that knows a lot about commissioning and can tell me some things that I need to be aware of?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I have some experience of commissioning, but I would like to do it better, you know, to be better at it and to be an active force in bringing more new music into the field and sharing it with more people and also making it sustainable. So
Yeah. One
of my big things about that was you know, who knows about commissioning funds in
mm-hmm.
particular? It's because I would like to have a very robust commissioning fund, and that's going to require lots of different parts and pieces
mm-hmm.
that go into filling that out. And so I'm really excited that we're talking with Alex today about these types of things. And I kind of want to kick it off with maybe Alex talking a little bit about different types of commissioning models that she's been a part of.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you can put them in a hierarchy if you like, or just kind of talking about different models that you've used in the past, or does it all kind of boil down to one idea? Because like the idea is being, somebody pays you to write music. I think
the idea is that.
The idea is that you get paid.
A happy musical relationship and a fair financial one if that is attainable. And
yes.
I have always gone through my approach to this with a lot of creative ideas about how to make this work for both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So one side is, yes, the composer in a perfect world should be paid enough money that it contributes to their being able to pay their bills every month while they're writing the piece. And presumably, the composer also has other sources of income. I wrote a whole article about this earlier this year for New Music Box called Let's Make a List. And people can look that up and refer to it if they want, because one of the points I make repeatedly in the article is that most of us who are working composers, we're not just getting one chunk of income. We're
mm-hmm.
making our income probably from 8 or 9 or 10 different sources every month.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is to create a flow.
Yeah.
So some of the chunks will be bigger, possibly a commission fee installment, something like that. And many of them will be very small, like a sonata score sale or something like that, you know. It can go in all directions, but by the end of the month you've found that you've collected, you know, a fair amount of income, kind of like a happy little dung beetle rolling its piece of dung down the road, you know, collecting as it goes.
Are you making a value judgment about my music, Alex?
there's my analogy, my metaphor for the day. So here we are, the happy little dung beetles, and you want to collect music and I want to collect money. Let's put it that way, and I want to collect catalog works, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there are a lot of things that both of us need. And I want to just start by saying any performer that is intent on building the repertoire and bringing in composers into the fold and adding to the repertoire is just fabulous. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a really, really great thing. And we want to encourage that. And that means that, of course, everybody's at a different level and a different place in their careers financially, and different things are going to be within reach or not. Mm-hmm. But the intent is equally wonderful no matter where one is. And so the trick is to, from the composer's side, is if they can, find ways to make it work no matter where the resources are coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, make it work for everybody because it's just a fabulous thing to do. So... okay, I'm going to just run down sort of plan A, B, C, D, you know, various creative ways that financing can be achieved. So hopefully these are all win-wins for everybody. So plan A would be the more obvious one. Find out what kind of budget the commissioner has, if you can find out in round figures or have a sense. And that means, is the commissioner paying out of their own pocket, or did they just get a big grant? Mm-hmm. You know, yada, yada, the basic stuff. If we're looking at one-stop shopping of one commissioner, an ensemble or an individual. And so in that case, the traditional manner of paying for a piece of music is to give the composer 50% of the fee at the signing of the contract. And by the way, everybody, please put everything in writing. Please protect yourselves. Make things clear. That's a whole nother podcast. So usually, traditionally, 50% of the fee is at the signing of the contract, and then the other 50% is paid to the composer upon the delivery of the score and parts. Mm-hmm. And by the way, for composers and performers, avoid agreeing to have the second 50% paid upon the premiere of the piece, because we all know there can be delays, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes under the worst of circumstances, you know, it could be years, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So try. I've occasionally seen that kind of language, and I caution people against it. Mm-hmm. You want to, you know, when you've done your work as the composer, because now I'm speaking to everybody, whether you're a performer or a composer, right? Mm-hmm. So for the composers out there, you have a right to be paid once you deliver the finished score and parts, you know, and everything's playable and there aren't, you know, horrific typos and undoable page turns for 18 pages in a row and all that stuff. Yeah. You know, you've done your job, you've been a professional, and you deserve to be paid. So one helpful tactic.
Can I jump in on that point?
Oh, sure, Dennis.
I think that's a really important thing to point out, because not everybody really knows contracts, and I wanted to have a whole episode on contracts, at least one episode, a billion. But making sure that the payment deadlines are based on something that the composer does and not that the performer does. I mean, that's what you're kind of getting at. I've seen a situation that went south very quickly where and this was not for concert music, this was for film music, but like the first half was due at a weird time that actually did have to do with what the composer delivered, but then the final payment wasn't due until like the producer approved the final score. And this was a really shady company that, you know, that this composer, you know, accidentally got into bed with. And they ended up having to fight and threaten lawsuits to get that final payment, because this company was just going to, like, hold it and say, like, well, we haven't really approved it, you know, and the movie was going to come out and they still weren't going to have to, like, finally approve it. So make sure that payment is due.
The composer. Yeah.
Exactly. Make sure that's due on, like, delivery, something that's tangible that the composer has done.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that puts the onus on the composer, you know, that's very important.
Yeah.
The composer has to be a professional and make sure that they hit the deadline mark. And if, by the way, if a composer isn't, and now we're getting into contract talk, but, you know, it's really very important that composers know that hand-holding, as I like to call it, with the client is really, really important, even when things are going great. But it's important to touch base, you know, from time to time during the commission to let your client know how things are going.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not the end of the world if you are going to be a little late on something, but it is the end of the world if you you don't tell anybody.
Yes.
So you have to, if you can see, and it pretty much everybody can see this coming down the pike. And I'm not, by the way, I'm talking about concert music. I'm not going to delve into the whole film and TV world, because that is a completely different animal, different deadlines, different everything. So for the sake of this conversation today, assume that everything I'm talking about is for concert music.
Yeah. And, and in terms of like, also if the commissioner is worried about what if I don't like the piece, that's where communication is really key throughout the process to like, you know, maybe put something in the contract to say that you get to see it at certain points to make sure that you're getting something that's not going to like be unplayable or something.
Sure.
That you just, like, so you can like go back to the drawing board and, right, and make it right. So the composer can just deliver what you want.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's another point. We can talk more about that because that's an interesting point. But certainly if the composer senses because, you know, they got the flu or whatever, they broke a couple of fingers, like someone I know, they cripple themselves and they can't quite do something on time. Just let people know and just say, can I, you know, can I have an extra 2 weeks or a month or whatever? If there isn't, you know, sometimes there's a performance date and then that's, you know, that is not going to waver.
Yeah.
And there's a performance date attached often, and you're going to hit that mark no matter what. Other times, it's more pliable, and you can, and you know you have a little wiggle room, and it's just important to, you know, wiggle graciously. That's
wiggle
my motto, graciously.
Gracious. I like that a lot.
So there we have it. So there's that. So always let your client know what's up, and if you're running late, let them know. So regarding payment, back to payment, because one helpful thing that I have found sometimes gets overlooked is to offer the commissioner the possibility of paying in several installments over a prescribed period of time rather than just two, you know, half and half. Because this can really ease the burden and create a very nice cash flow for the composer. It makes it easier for the client. Because they're paying out smaller amounts of money, and it makes it easier, and it makes it kind of fun for the composer. And that, you're getting a smaller chunk, but it's coming more often, and that contributes to what I wrote about in that article about having cash flow and just keeping that stream moving. So I often recommend that. So okay, on to another tactic. If the individual commissioner, if their budget simply isn't enough for a new piece, Plan B is to see about forming a consortium of commissioners, a group of like-minded ensembles or soloists, people who would be interested in this, in the same kind of piece for whatever reasons. Or that can also include donors, you know, people who are not even musicians who just want to support something. But it's a collective. And that collective, that consortium or consortia, can bring the piece to life. And in that, that works very nicely because the composer can sit down and decide what they really need to get for their efforts. And I, there are two numbers that have to be looked at, and I recommend looking at them separately. Even if you do lump them together, think of them separately. One is the actual composing fee, and the other is assuming you are either doing or hiring out for music preparation. That takes a lot of time, and score and parts prep. And if you're doing something electroacoustic, there's recording and engineering and mixing and mastering and all those other things. Because at that point, you're a record producer as well as a, as a composer, as I know so well. So, because that's a lot of my, a lot of what I do. So you want to make sure, the composer wants to make sure that they have a good idea of what they truly need to bring this piece to life comfortably without having to eat, you know, 60-cent boxes of mac and cheese all month. You know, they deserve to be able to eat well. And to that end, the good thing about a consortium is that, or as some people say, consortium, there are two ways of pronouncing it. The good thing about it is that the composer can simply put enough people together to make up that fee, and everybody's paying substantially lower. For instance, in the band world, I've seen consortia fees or consortium fees as low as $250 a participant up to $1,000 a participant. But all of those numbers are within reach, you know, as opposed to, you know, several thousand dollars and upward for a piece coming from one one client. So it's a great, great business model, and there's so much that's great about it because not only are is the composer getting paid fairly, but a lot of people are getting a new piece, and presumably they're from different regions of the world or the country or whatever, and they're all going to have their regional premieres, And so they're happy. The audiences, a lot of audiences hear this piece. It gets broad exposure for the piece right out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a lot of buzz for the piece. Mm-hmm. And it works this way a lot in the wind band world, has been very quick to adopt this.
Mm-hmm.
And now increasingly I see chamber music and other groups doing mm-hmm. it as well. But you'll hear about this a lot in wind band. And it's magic because the band directors get very excited about a good piece when they've got one, and mm-hmm. they can't wait to tell everybody else about it. It's not proprietary.
Mm-hmm.
They don't ask for exclusivity, thank goodness. And
mm-hmm.
I always caution people to avoid exclusivity if you can, because it doesn't serve anybody,
mm-hmm.
including the commissioners. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's no point. You mm-hmm. want to build the buzz about something when it's hot, when it's out there.
Yeah.
And that's great for everybody. And it's really great for the names of the ensembles and the reputations of the ensembles that are supporting the new piece.
Mm-hmm.
So the consortium model would be plan B. Once it becomes clear that the one client person can't quite do this, even over installments. You know, they don't have the grant or they don't have the deep pocket or whatever the thing is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, plan C, you can stop me now, but I'll keep going.
No, I want to know about this is the part where we start to get into the stuff, Alex, that I really need to know about, because it's like my list always goes, okay, so there's grants. Basically, if this money is flowing through me as the commissioner
mm-hmm.
and then I'm working, you know, with a trio, I'm working with a small ensemble that's like young in its development.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm looking to build this fund of mm-hmm. commissions of sorts, then I need to, I clearly know about grants and I clearly know about donors and I clearly
right.
know about consortium models that
right.
like, not to say that we don't want to talk about those. I do want to talk about those. but then when I think those are the ones that you can kind of go, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. And then on top of that, or like deeper into those
mm-hmm.
is like, where do we go from those points? Because if I'm a young ensemble, I clearly don't have a whole lot of like granting stuff that's available to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a slightly different instrumentation. So I don't have a huge consortium model that I can
mm-hmm.
run.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
right.
you know, everybody gets these then slightly different, everybody's bringing their own parameters to
mm-hmm.
their ability to commission. And then thinking more creatively around those parameters is kind of what I need to do, and forcing myself to do that and then going, okay, but are there more parts of this list that I'm not considering yet?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You betcha. This is good. Now, this is great, especially when you talk about having, let's say, an instrumentation that's slightly unusual,
mm-hmm.
you know, with mezzo-soprano and whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Plan another approach. And it works very well for less common instrumentations, is for the composer to look at their catalog carefully of what already exists
mm-hmm.
and to find something or hopefully several pieces to show the commissioner that might work very well as an adaptation of an existing work
mm-hmm.
in her or his catalog, because this is going to cost less money, of course, because the piece is already written. It takes great thought. I mean, it is not always easy to make a very good adaptation, because my rule about adaptations is that it should sound as though it was the original instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that's a very well done adaptation, is
mm-hmm.
when it is as thoughtfully written for the new instruments with the same music or roughly the same. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
you make musical changes too. But it's very thoughtfully done to the point where you can't tell which was the original version.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, so it's cheaper for everybody. It results in a fresh piece
mm-hmm.
and fresh version premieres for the commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also breathes new life and distribution into that existing work in the composer's catalog.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So it expands its reach. So something that was presumably a good work to begin with and the composer's proud of it, suddenly that work's getting out there to a whole new slew of audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had many experiences with adaptations where the second or third version of an original piece is the one that sort of becomes the best known one. And that's the one that gets recorded or gets performed a lot or whatever. And then the original one, which is perfectly good, but gets done like a third of the time compared to the later ones. And it's kind of funny. It's like, but wait. But everybody likes the weird one. Yeah. So fine. the one with the odd instrumentation. But anyway, adaptations is a great thing to turn to because you're still getting a fresh piece, and it's still a premiere. It's still exciting, but it's a lot more affordable.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be a fraction of the cost of a new piece.
Right.
Now I'm going to continue because there's Plan D, and Plan D can be really fun. And this is particularly true for, I would say, younger ensembles or ensembles getting started, composers getting started. But one could do this at any point in their career. I would do this tomorrow if it was if there was something for which this is appropriate. And it is sort of a trade. and you can decide what you're trading. But let's say if someone really wants a brand new work, not an adaptation, in return for that new work from the composer, the performer or performers will agree to not only perform it and premiere it, but they'll agree to record it, which is very valuable, right? Record it and hopefully video it as well. The composer will own the master recording, okay, which is the copyright to the sound recording,
right?
From which that composer can see income down the line for sync licenses, other things, publishing, obviously. So you want to own the master whenever possible. And if the performers do this, let's say, under a musicians union contract, that's fine. The composer can file what's known as a low-budget agreement, and you can pay the pension and health and welfare into the performer's funds, which is very important to do. It's very inexpensive, and it's very important because if it's a union group of musicians, they really rely on these funds for their health care. And it's getting harder and harder, frankly, to keep your health care because the demands that the union puts on how many performances and gigs you do, you know, how many recordings, it's not easy.
Yeah.
And so you can do that. And then basically the musicians would waive their hourly fee, which is also very low. And that would be their gift. That would be their contribution. It's like, we're going to record this. We're giving of our time. You pay into the health and welfare and pension, you know, and that's fair. I think that's very fair. And then ideally the performers also, because they're getting a piece for free, if they can, they would try to cover some or all of the studio and engineer costs. If they can put some money together over time, you know, that they have a lot of lead time to put that money together. And then they can make a professional recording. It's all negotiable, but these are some thoughts. And so, you know, in the past, for instance, I've given players then who do this, I give them a free license to use that master on their CD if they want to, right? Because, of course, the more it gets out, the better. You want that recording out there. So they're getting a recording for their next album, their next disc, their next download, stream, whatever we want to call it, infusion of music. And the composer has that master to do with as they wish to. So that's a win-win. And then, again, shooting a video for YouTube or something is a really strong advantage for everybody.
Yeah.
And then that goes viral. Everybody puts it up on their website and uses it. So everything that I've mentioned, I'm sure there are people smarter out there than me who are saying, oh, but there's this and that and that. You can do these things too. And you're absolutely right. So throw other things into that mix of trades. Because anything can be bartered and traded. Whatever is of worth to both parties, you know, or it makes a good deal. Because the concept is fairness, that it takes a great deal of work to put together a good new piece. And it takes a great deal of work to rehearse and learn and perform a great new piece, right? It's a lot of work on both ends.
Yeah.
And so you want it to be fair and equitable on whatever scale that you're doing it. And, you know, a recording is highly valuable. If someone says to me, you know, I don't have much money, but I guarantee you we're going to do a very professional recording and you can own it and you can use it however you want, I'm going to look very seriously at that. That matters a lot to me.
Right.
So, because that's real stock and trade. So that's a plan D. So the other two, you know, so we talked about, you know, different ways to finance and installation payments and installment payments and, you know, a consortium and an adaptation and trade. Bartering, finding ways to trade things that are very important to each other. So that's my overview on creative financing ideas. And I've used all of these interchangeably. I'm sure I've done other things that are escaping my brain right now, but it's all in a flow. Like, you look at what the client needs if you're the composer. Always think about everything from someone else's perspective. Try not to think of it just from yours. I mean, you already know you want to get paid money to write good music. That's a fair thing. You know that. But you got to look at what the needs of the client are and what their abilities are and what would work for them and and different kinds of pieces are different. You know, band music is different than music for a mezzo-soprano. You know, mm-hmm. It's a different thing, mm-hmm. different animal. Unless it's mezzo and band.
Let's well, make
which
that
there
happen,
are not
everybody.
That many pieces.
I know. I will make a note of that. And eventually,
yes. Put me at the top of your list if you're writing mezzo and wind ensemble music.
Yeah, I've heard you. You're awesome. Don't tempt me.
Yeah,
I'll come at
so
you.
Nice. So, but I think what you're saying is exactly the stuff that I'm thinking about, and I'm trying to pull these little threads together to kind mm-hmm. of weave that mm-hmm. tapestry for working with lots of composers, and I'm trying to be, you know, equitable and sustainable for these composers right. in a lot of ways. And also wondering, and then that other side is making sure that I'm bringing those income streams, I guess, or those streams of funding into that, that's not just taking paychecks from singing and like funneling that straight to the composer. Like I don't mind doing that sometimes mm-hmm. because that's what's going to happen. But that takes a lot of like my performance of like that I'm not being sustainable for myself as a mm-hmm. business
right.
because I'm being a conduit of funding. Mm-hmm. And
that's
then
right.
I worry about that because I don't want to be a part of bringing all of the funds down for mm-hmm. everybody involved. I want to be a part of bringing all the funds up.
Like, right. Which is
so
noble. And you absolutely need to eat and pay for a roof over your head yourself. And mm-hmm. so now one thing one can always do is sort of tithe to their own commissioning fund, right? You can
yes.
get your paycheck for singing and put 10% of it, 20% of it mm-hmm. aside if you can do that toward a fund that you're creating to do this. But it's, exactly. you know, with money is very tight and expenses are high in different places where people live. And I would never presume mm-hmm. that that's even comfortable for people mm-hmm. to do. It's very tough. It's very, very tough to do, which is why I think that the group collective consortium model mm-hmm. can be so powerful, because for everybody to, you know, find $500, let's say, to put in mm-hmm. is and get a whole bunch of people doing that, then you've got a real going concern at that point.
Yeah.
For something. And it's still within reach of people.
Right.
So that's something, you know, that I have always looked at as the most realistic model, because then it's just a matter of collecting the biggest number of people necessary, or the correct number of people necessary for the fee that the composer should be paid for the scope of the work. And we all know that that's a sliding scale.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I'm sure it's been said a million times, but for anybody listening, New Music USA has a really terrific resource chart. Mm-hmm. It was formerly the Meet the Composer chart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you go to New Music USA, I actually bookmarked this, newmusicusa.org/about/resources,
mm-hmm.
folks. Go to that. And you'll see a pretty accurate span of ranges based on instrumentation and duration, which are the two mm-hmm. main ways. There are other things too, but those are the two main things we look at when it the scope of a piece when it comes to determining how much is it going to cost to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it's a sliding scale, because someone at the very beginning of their career deserves to be paid, but is not going to garner quite as much money, you know, as someone, you know, who's 99 years old and been doing this a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think just to jump back a little bit to the recordings and, you know, or potentially like, having more performances, like agreeing to more performances within a certain span of time, because that ends up giving royalties. Like if those are licensable performances,
mm-hmm.
Then
right.
that's money going into the composer's pocket, you know, because you should be filling out your, you know, your ASCAP and BMI licensing things and making sure that, you know, everybody gets what they're due. But yeah, with the recording, I mean, that ends up being sometimes infinitely more, actually, not sometimes, it's infinitely more valuable for a composer than just the premiere, because the premiere happened once,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
that was it. Whereas the recording goes on and on, and it speaks for the work. It's it's, you know, a piece of marketing material for the work. It can, you know, get other performers interested in it. It can get, you know, it can have a life as like, you know, a, an an asset on iTunes, you know, like you can do your work out things with the performer for, you know, paying royalties and making sure that everybody's making, you know, pennies on this thing. You know, you have your little trickle
everybody's
of pennies.
Fractions of pennies.
Yeah. Just keep it off Spotify so you actually have pennies and not just like thousands of pennies. but yeah, it ends up being like a great long-term asset. Like right now, I'm looking at my catalog and saying, oh, look, all this stuff doesn't have a decent recording.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, maybe I have the recording of the premiere performance, which was, you know, and that premiere did nothing for me because only a handful of people saw it. And that, you know, the recording of that premiere is archival, so it's not going to do me a lot of good. And it wasn't a very good performance to begin with. So it absolutely does me no good. But having, like, spending the time to put together, like, a good recording, that's super valuable for me. That's
super valuable.
Really, really going to be helpful long term and can help to generate income for everybody.
Right. Yeah, that's something that we're thinking about as the trio quite a bit, is making sure that, because that's part of our mission statement, is to record, you know, underperformed or under-recorded composers, is that the way that our trio functions is on a model of getting together in residency type situations where we have a lot more like rehearsal time and recordings, and like that being performances plus recordings at every juncture when we get together, that we're really working towards that, with that in mind, because we know that these are the we want to work with composers. And so what do we do as performers that it's going to make that beneficial for them as well as for us to reach our goals? And that's part of it. So I think that, and there is a lot of that with the trade of saying, okay, well, this is the model that we work on. So if you want to work with us, we can't offer you a lot of things. We're going to keep working on that, but you'll definitely get decent recordings and things that you can use, and multiple performances, because we'll be together on this and this time. I think that where was I going to go with this? That, of getting together for, working with composers, maybe you guys can tell me a little bit more about this, is that as I'm talking to people, we're building out this list, and a lot of it is going towards like, okay, this might happen in the future, or can you tell me more about grants that you have access to, and talking to our collaborators and being like, okay, in our funding process at the moment, like this is not happening, so we can move this off to the future and then tie it to a funding. Like, do you work with any of your performers to say like, this is, set up the details of a potential project together, and then say, okay, now I have to go do the funding part? Because that's usually my job, is being the person who's going to make the funding happen, is talking to my composers and saying, can you tell me what you need from this project, and then bringing the money to that point, rather than going, oh, sure, I have money right now, we'll do exactly that thing, is mainly identifying the people that you want to work with, figuring out what they need, and then going, okay, our timeline is now going to be this, because I have to raise the money to get to that juncture.
Right. Yeah, I think that's super smart. because, you know, any project, I mean, when I'm thinking about any project, the first thing I do is I make a budget. You know, I have my budget template spreadsheet, and I just say, this is what this is going to cost me, and this is what I need to make in order to make it happen. And, you know, is that realistic? And if you know what the project is going to cost you, if you can know from the composer, okay, this is what, you know, I'd like out of this, and maybe that's a mixture of, you know, commissioning funds, touring the piece, making a recording, you know, some combination of any or all of those, then you can say, okay, then I have to bring this much money in. I have to find this money.
Yep. Yeah. Until you build that robust commissioning fund, and you're like, well, this is what we're working with.
Well, this is where I would jump in and just say that I think it's incumbent on the composer to participate in the bringing in of the consortium members, if that's the funding model that's being used. that the composer themselves presumably has a following of people that love what they do, that have purchased their material before, have performed it, have Skyped with them, know them, whatever, gone out drinking with them, whatever they've done. They've got hopefully a very good database, and I can speak a lot about the power of databases, so that they can help the performer, as they should, raise the needed money. I think that it shouldn't be that hard to do. I have a rundown method of how to do it, and it's something that is part of the partnership to me. It's not just a musical partnership, but you are talking about a business partnership.
Right.
And it's the business of bringing beauty and music to the world. That's a great thing, bringing expression and emotion to the world. That's your business. No shame in that word, folks. And so I always see myself as a collaborative partner with the person or entity that's commissioning me. I'm collaborating with them in one way or another or many ways.
Right. Well, Alex, and you brought up a point earlier when we were talking about, since we're kind of talking about timeline too, that about how to be approached by composers about potentially working together. And I find that this is kind of what I wish composers would know a little bit more about, that I'm really trying, but that, that a process starts with like, let's talk, and then, oh yeah, we're probably going to work well together. I'd like to start a project together. That I, when I get asked by composers and they say, okay, what is your commissioning like budget look like? And I'm like, that's cute.
My commissioning budget, they apparently think that you're like Santa Claus with a really big sack of money over your shoulder or something.
And I'm like, okay, that's exactly how my life looks. And so I say, okay, well, my commissioning budget looks like whatever we make it. And so that goes along with timeline. And if we want to do this project, what, so I always start kind of with like, what kind of project do we want to do together? Where, why do you see us working together? I would like to work with you. And so I would like to work with you because of this, this, and this reason in the way that you write music, or because I really like you as a collaborator. I like your ideas and things like that. And then going into, that's kind of the first part is like, let's talk about, you know, why we want to be a musical collaborative team and then go details of what would we need to make that work. And then we start doing the funding process, or I'm kind of putting the puzzle pieces together and going like, okay, if we apply for this, and then hopefully, you know, the composer on the other side or anybody that's a part of that togetherness is finding out ways where we can bring more funding to the process to make it happen. And then we can kind of talk about, as part of timeline, talking about contracts here is, when do you, do you start with contracts at the beginning of that? Do you start at contracts at like a certain point? Because mine tend to be like, let's do the chatting part, making sure that this is a project that we'd like to do. And then tell me about what your timeline would look like for something like this. And then we start doing contracts as some of those pieces start to come together a little bit more, or you kind of see an outline of a picture, or you put like, you know, the corners of the puzzle pieces together and you go,
the corners,
if I get the corners first.
I mean, you can't, you have to do the talking and the imagining of what the project is and general, you know, the general, you know, mulling it before you put anything down in writing. And you have to have a feel for what this is going to be. That makes complete sense. One thing I'll say is, depending on the composer, if you're starting to think that you want to negotiate or talk with or work with a composer who's really, really, really busy, you might want to try to put a little something down just to nail a time frame down, because composers will be booked, you know, 2, 3, or more years ahead. And so if you're thinking about a project, especially a larger project, anything larger, if you can, you don't have to have the full contract, but perhaps you could get, if you wanted to protect yourself as you go forward, trying to piece this together, maybe get something in writing with the composer saying that where that composer agrees that they are amenable to doing the project with you. Something real basic like that, just so that you've, you've put in one corner of the puzzle piece. You've nailed in one corner, so it's not going to fly off the wall, right?
And I think that that part of like saying, I like contracts for a little bit more of that communication about timeline, just to say, I would like for this project to move forward. I got to go do some other parts to make that happen, but I'm committing to, I'm doing those other parts and staying in communication during that, I think is very helpful.
Absolutely.
As something where we both said, maybe, you know, signed our names to it, where it's like, okay, we're on a timeline together for mm-hmm. this project, but the other parts are happening now mm-hmm. before I can fully, you know, put in the next part for getting you started on the composing part.
Yeah.
I don't want to make anybody sign on to something without being like, here is more definite stuff for you mm-hmm. to do.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the other thing you can add to the timeline is the timeline for when you will be moving forward with the contract or,
exactly.
or what mm-hmm. things need to be put into place before you can move forward with the contract and put a timeline for yourself. It's mm-hmm. very helpful, right? Because things can just float into the ether if we don't, mm-hmm. you know, nail them down. Put into writing a timeline, a projected timeline or deadline by which you are hoping to have mm-hmm. the first 50% of the funding available or
yeah.
ready or something like that, whatever the thing is.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a million different things. But there's no harm in putting deadlines on a number of different aspects
yeah.
of it because these projects can be very complicated.
Yeah,
I mean, because it's for you as a performer, it's not just the music. The music's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's the rehearsal time. Mm-hmm. There's the booking of the venues
mm-hmm.
and the dates. I mean, my gosh, there's many more things than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated putting
right.
together a
yeah.
new piece or a concert, you know, anything. So there are many contingencies.
Yeah.
Right. And that's usually my concern with people that are like, what's your commissioning budget? And I'm
mm-hmm.
like, well, my commissioning budget is I have to figure out how I'm going to make all of those parts work. And
mm-hmm.
so do you want to sign on to that? And this is going to be a long-term project together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely sure that younger or more emerging composers, developing composers are aware of when I'm like, okay, I would like to do a project with you. And now
mm-hmm.
I have to also go manage the performances and getting the rehearsals
mm-hmm.
together
mm-hmm.
and those other parts. And of course I'd like to pay you a big check, but
yeah.
you've just asked to work together for the next 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
And I would like to do that, but are you committed to that? Or are you just committed to the check?
Yeah.
And
right.
And we have to be on the same page about those.
Yeah. I think one
Absolutely.
Thing that you can do to sort of, make the process easier and not worry
mm-hmm.
so much about the contract, but like both of you, but you know, both sides sign a letter of commitment, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you're not putting down money. You're not putting down, like, it's basically like, this is a vague time frame that we're looking at. We're committed to sticking this through. Both sides are, you know, able to back out, you know, like have exit clauses. So it's like, if this isn't going to work, we can break this off without, you know, being in breach of contract and, you know, having somebody get really upset. And then once you reach a certain point where like, okay, I know that the money is going to come in. I know that things are going to be much more stable. Then sign an actual contract for the commission. But like
mm-hmm.
both of you commit in writing to explore this and work honestly toward that goal. And then ultimately say, okay, now we're ready.
Yeah.
Right. I think a letter of intent is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That's very
mm-hmm.
helpful. And that makes it solid from the composer's standpoint. It becomes
mm-hmm.
something that the composer then puts in their book, so to speak, if
mm-hmm.
they have a book, as I do, of commissions of things coming up in a certain
mm-hmm.
chronological order, because
mm-hmm.
otherwise you can't keep track of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, once there's some, you know, intent that's quite tangible or real
mm-hmm.
written down, then it goes in the book. It's like, yeah, okay, I can look at
mm-hmm.
2019 sometime in the spring. I'm going to be doing this, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm hoping, you know, and yes, there's not every project goes through, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
But it's very important. It's very helpful for everybody as they're planning their lives and their schedules around
mm-hmm.
all this stuff.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Can we talk about payments? If you've worked with organizations and individuals that are commissioning, how are you most often getting paid? Is that like a they cut you a check from their general fund and then they're paying, like, you know, are they probably, for organizations, you're signing tax forms, and then for individuals, are you also doing that? Where are those logistics lining up?
That's a good question. Well, I'm thinking of, there's one organization that I've done, I think, 3 pieces with over the years, Composers and Schools in Concert. It's
mm-hmm.
a wonderful group that brings new music into high schools for all
mm-hmm.
kinds of ensembles.
Nice.
And I did 3 different band pieces with them over the years. And so in that case, they were the umbrella organization that also served as the, you know, as the financial the fiscal agent, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
the same way American Composers Forum does this, or Fractured Atlas, right? You know, there
mm-hmm.
are a number of places that are 501(c)(3)s, very important,
mm-hmm.
so they are nonprofits. and they will be the ones receiving all the money from the participants, even if it's just one. Mm-hmm. One client, you know, one commissioner, and certainly if it's quite a number of them. And then they are the ones, they'll take a small amount off the top for their expenses, and then they give the rest to the composer. And by the way, you already know what those numbers are, so it doesn't affect the composer's fee. You simply mm-hmm. raise enough money to make sure the composer gets what they need to get, mm-hmm. you know, after that fee has been taken out. So there's no mystery to that.
Right.
So that's one way of doing it. And then, obviously, in terms of individuals, it can be quite casual. It has to do with how the individual wants to handle their taxes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, because that's a business expense for them, and mm-hmm. it's something exactly. that should be deductible. So it's something that, yes, and without question, the composer should be paying taxes on mm-hmm. what they receive, because right. we are good citizens. Mm-hmm. That is why. And we do not like jail, because we do not look good in orange.
No,
so for
no.
all those reasons, we pay our taxes, and we pay yeah. them on time.
Mm.
And so you don't have, the commissioner should not usually have to deduct taxes from it. It should be up to the composer, mm-hmm. the sole proprietor, to just, you know, do the right thing mm-hmm. and take a chunk of that money and put it aside mm-hmm. to pay Uncle Sam.
Right. Do you guys, yeah. either of you, have any resources for people that are concerned about that part, about the taxes of commissioning and making sure that they get all the forms, like, signed? Or that, because at a certain point, at a certain dollar amount, as an individual, mm-hmm. you have to have people sign tax forms?
Right, right. I and think, so, you know what you could do? Fractured Atlas might have some resources mm-hmm. for you, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah, maybe.
Right?
Yeah, probably. I know I've done some work for, you know, work, not... This isn't a commissioning thing, but I think it uh-huh. works essentially the same way, where, you know, he's a guy who's got, you know, he's incorporated, and mm-hmm. At a certain point he said, I just need you to fill out this W. I always get the numbers mixed up, and then you know, by the end of January, he, you know, he'll just stop by and say, here's your 1099, and mm-hmm. you right. know. You know, that's over $599, you know, basically yeah. $600 and up, need a 1099. So if you're, you know, doing over $600 commissioning fee, which you probably are, then it's really, I mean, he fills it out by hand.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you just, the composer just gives that to their, you know, CPA and ta-da. Mm-hmm.
So, but just for anybody that is also doing it, that, you know, wants to make sure that they're doing it correctly, if you you're paying somebody more than $599, mm-hmm. that you also
I didn't
to
even know that number, Dennis. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know what the limits were or weren't.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, and I'm pretty damn sure that that's the number, because my dad's a CPA yeah. and I tend to know some tax stuff.
Yeah.
It's CPA in the family.
I know. He doesn't do my taxes
anymore.
Really? so useful.
I know. It has been. Yeah, I'm pretty damn sure that's the number. But I mean, if you're, like, Megan, if you're kind of on the front end of things with, like, if you're preparing your taxes at the end of the calendar year, you should be ready to go by the end of January, and that's mm-hmm. something you can actually bring to your tax preparer and say, mm-hmm. hey, this is this expense, I know I need to get, like, this, walk me through it. And that's
yeah.
part of your preparation right there, because they're going to want to make sure that that's listed you know, as expense properly with the proper documentation for
right.
you. And so I'm sure they will walk you through that. And it's
right.
super easy.
Right.
It's just fill out this form. You send in your copy, and then, you know, the composer sends in theirs with their taxes.
Yeah. Sounds good.
That's a good question to ask.
Mm-hmm.
It is, because, well, I mean, it doesn't come up a lot.
Yeah.
People
yeah,
don't, the fine point of how do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, no one teaches you that in music school, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've had so many clients.
Well, if you're the person that's commissioning and you're the one that's cutting the check, like,
mm-hmm.
there's a part that, you know, you want to make sure, or that I'm thinking about is the nuts and bolts of hi, dog. Creating the nuts and bolts of creating a commissioning fund, which means, okay, I'm going to be funneling funds
mm-hmm.
into this area because I'm working with a lot of different composers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only one check from here gets funneled straight to this person. It's like, I'm putting checks into this fund so that
mm-hmm.
budgets can get taken care of.
Yeah.
So when I'm trying to get grants for these projects and things like that, that it would go into that, most likely a into your fiscal sponsorship, because if we're like a smaller, mm-hmm. you know, we're not an organization, I'm not creating an LLC or anything like that for this, but getting a fiscal sponsor to get that started and then put the money in there and then passing mm-hmm. that through and just making sure that you're ticking off all those boxes. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to be in grad school and have your friend write you a piece and then you mm-hmm. agree to perform it on your recital. Right. It's a whole nother thing when you're like, I'm actually doing this. This is my career. Mm-hmm. I need to make right. sure that we like dot these I's and cross these T's, and I'm trying to create something that's more self-sustaining mm-hmm. rather than just one-off performances after one-off performances mm-hmm. and trying to like give people, you know, more than something to post on Facebook about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That I'm
yeah.
like, you know, I'm actually doing this, and this is a part of our mission as a group. I care about this, and this is how this starts to become a flow. Like you said, Alex, on my side of the commissioning process, is that it becomes a flow of working with lots of composers mm-hmm. and actually being able to fund that process and bringing money in and sending mm-hmm. money out appropriately mm-hmm. rather than like, oh yeah, sure, I can just like turn okay, I'm gonna get paid this much for that gig, and so I'll just plan to give you half of that and like mm-hmm. turn it into that. Like, that's not where I want to be mm-hmm. yeah. as a performer that does this that does this regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're really smart. You're really smart to see it in the way that you are seeing it, and seeing the pitfalls of doing it in a more casual way, without as much forward thinking about how that ends up affecting your budget personally.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think planning is essential, and you're treating it really, really like a business and a professional approach to building this as a long-term project. It's fantastic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think we get stuck because, well, I just did a crowdfunding campaign that we sometimes get stuck with thinking of crowdfunding as being like the only funding source if mm-hmm. you're not actively getting grants, or if mm-hmm. you don't have those institutional ties, or mm-hmm. right, institutional being like academic institutional or larger ensemble institutional. Mm-hmm. If you don't have those ties, then you kind of feel like you're, you know, out in the wilderness trying to like put mm-hmm. things together. And yeah. I think if we can make, I would hope that there's a pattern there. There's a path to walk down that says like, I started by just working out in a trade organization or trade situation with a composer friend. And then you start doing it a little bit more regularly and you start mm-hmm. to figure out, okay, well, this works this way. I've gotten some logistics for how to create a timeline together, how to create contracts together, how to mm-hmm. do those logistics.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see the third part as kind of moving more into that. I have a fund. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly bringing money into that fund so that I can use that fund to sustain activities over the course of seasons mm-hmm. rather than just project to project.
Yeah.
I think that that's usually the, what am I trying to say? The evolution
yeah.
that
yep.
Consistent commissioners follow if they're coming from the performer side.
Mm-hmm.
Who have your role models been as ensembles for doing it this way?
Well, I think that I definitely look to Bang on a Can as being, you know, they're so smart about, they got together and they said, okay, well, we're creating all this music mm-hmm. and we right. can work together to really do this. And then they created an ensemble, and then they created a commissioning fund, and mm-hmm. they've been able to, if you see like the various arms that they've put together in one hub, mm-hmm. I really appreciate that and try to think of myself as going, okay, these are all arms, all spokes off mm-hmm. of the hub mm-hmm. that I'm mm-hmm. trying to create as my career, just the same way that we're all trying to have various income streams and mm-hmm. and creating that portfolio lifestyle of saying, okay, I'm a composer, but I get paid to do this, 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 and this, you mm-hmm. know, I get
right.
paid in these different ways. That I'm trying to also think of myself that way. And I think that ICE does this incredibly well, mm-hmm. obviously, and creates a model where I think what ICE is doing with ICE Commons right now mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. excellent.
Yeah.
Where you're creating a process that, yes, they're commissioning regularly, but they're also saying, we're very open to you communicating with us early in your process and mm-hmm. letting us see some scores so that we can start a pipeline mm-hmm. of composers into our commissioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking a lot about that as a performer
mm-hmm.
because we often start with those closest to us. You know, mm-hmm. you start with your friends and then you start with more friends and acquaintances, you know, mm-hmm. that that commissioning process often comes after building relationships that then you start to be able to work together. And then once you get to a point where you'd like to be able, when we're kind of talking about that third part where you have a fund and things like that to actually pay people, I think that's when it's appropriate to really start thinking about creating a pipeline to you so that you can do that. And I think that's what they do really well in that regard. There are tons of people that are commissioning individually all the time. And I think that there's a lot of ways that when we're talking about commissioning, I want it to be more visible so that people see that happening kind of constantly and know that that's something that we can also share. So as from the performer side, is that it works better for all of us if more performers are involved in commissioning, whether it's consortium model or sharing scores after the fact and making sure that there's a place to go where you can say, like, we don't only, this piece, even though we premiered it and we commissioned it, does not only belong to us, and we'd like to make sure that that lives in the world a little bit more.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, there are places that are doing that quite well, but I think as a field, it might be nice to heighten that visibility a little bit more of commissions that have happened that need more performances, and having a little bit more of a warehouse of some of those things. Because it's really great if you are actively commissioning, but if, like we said before, if that commission doesn't go anywhere after you pay for it and you perform it once, then
what's the
then you're not
tree falling in the forest.
Well, you're not probably contributing to the field as fully as the, as you would have hoped. You wanted to create, you wanted to bring more new music into the world, but then there's a follow through step for the, some after part. Maybe that's something that we could talk about, is we've talked about the beginning stages of commissioning and making sure that some of the logistics are there. What do we hope to see? What is an ideal commissioning process after the premiere?
Good question. Yeah. That's very good. I think certainly looking for continued opportunities for that new piece to see the light of day. First and foremost, obviously, with the commissioning ensemble, presumably they like it and want to keep playing it. And then certainly with the composers doing a lot of the legwork to find other such ensembles who would be interested in the piece, and contacting them and finding them through their own database, first of all. And then secondly, something that I did very early on when I was starting my concert music career at the ripe young age of 37, by the way, because I'd been in commercial music for all the years before that. So I was not a spring chicken, and I kind of hatched myself out of an egg and dropped to earth with not knowing anybody at age 37 in living in LA. I didn't know virtually anybody in the concert music world. I was completely outside of that world, but I decided for X, Y, Z reasons that it really was where my heart was and what I wanted to do. And I loved chamber music. And so one of the things that I did is I got a few new chamber works under my belt and got a few performances and recordings early on, and but was still completely, you know, a blip on the map, and nobody knew who I was. You know, this Alex guy, who is he? What's he doing? and so one of the things that I found is as I was building my catalog, that it became, it was also the birth of the internet. This was in the late 90s, and it was right when, you know, things were starting to take off with people using the net, and I was a very early adopter of that, and with my own site, et cetera, and ways to listen online, which was at the time pretty exotic, you know, kind of laughable now. But what I found is that cold contact, doing the research on the web and finding, and this pertains to your question about how, what happens to a piece afterwards, you have to work to get that piece out there. It's not going to just necessarily be discovered, right? Dennis knows this as a fellow composer and vocalist. I mean, you're the both whammy. You represent both of us, you know, Dennis. And nothing just comes to you while you're sitting on your sofa eating bonbons. You know?
Nope.
It takes a bit of follow through and taking the initiative. So what I did that worked so well, and I recommend this all the time to my colleagues, is I had a dedicated page for each one of my pieces in my growing catalog. That included, you know, a couple of score pages and where they could stream in an excerpt of the piece and read all the publishing information and, of course, a link to buy the score. I mean, it still is laid out that way on my site. And I would go through online possibly with a glass of wine at hand at 8:00 in the morning, you know, I'd start trolling and seeing, okay, what are the ocarina, tuba, and snare drum trios out there?
Mm-hmm. Alex, you were like telling everybody my Saturday night.
It's a glamorous life, isn't it?
It is.
Oh, it
so
is.
Glamorous.
So glamorous. They have no idea, do they? Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, that's me, Ms. Glamour, sitting there and trolling for ensembles. Mm-hmm. Looking for, you know, you find the instrumentation, and this is very helpful, especially for unusual instrumentation as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. And you find ensembles, maybe larger ensembles that include these instruments or something mm-hmm. really close, because always be thinking adaptation. Mm-hmm. And then you listen, you take the time to see what they're about and listen, mm-hmm. and you find the ones that are, of course, kind of in line artistically and aesthetically mm-hmm. with what you do, or at least what that one piece that you're thinking of getting out there is about. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't make sense to you know, contact an ensemble that doesn't play music that sounds anything like the style that your particular piece is in. I mean, that's mm-hmm. sort of a waste of time.
Yeah.
You know, try to make it easier on yourself, right? And then what I would do is I'd write them a very simple email mm-hmm. as a complete unknown stranger, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I would just say, you know, hello. I'm a composer in Los Angeles, and I'd say something very specific to them about mm-hmm. something I really liked about their playing or their repertoire or their music or their website or something, so that it was clear this was not a spam letter or something. Mm-hmm. This is a personal mm-hmm. email. Mm-hmm. And then I would say, there's a piece in my catalog that, you know, might be up your alley. I'd love to show it to you. If you're interested in seeing it, you can click on the link below, at which point you can stream an excerpt of it and read more about it, the program notes, mm-hmm. some score pages. And I wish you a wonderful performance season. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to staying in touch. Best, Alex. You know, real simple,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, about 8 out of 10 times, that worked amazingly well. Mm-hmm. People would write me back. They'd buy the piece. They'd perform the piece. Some of that led to commissions, mm-hmm. generally led to performances and recordings. It was great. And it was such a simple thing to do. It just took the time for the composer, right, to sit down and find a home or many homes mm-hmm. for that new piece. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of my recommendations to everybody listening. It's all right at your fingertips. The world,
totally.
The musical world, and audiences and performers are at our fingertips. All we have to do is take the time and just exhale and calm our minds mm-hmm. and sit down and enjoy the process of discovering mm-hmm. them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The same way, hopefully, they're going to stumble upon us, right, on our website,
mm-hmm.
Which happens all the time, right? And mm-hmm. people stumble upon you, and it's a marvelous thing. And this is the kind of example of why I often say that while there may be better times in the future, there has never been a better time so mm-hmm. far mm-hmm. than now to be a composer or a performer, because we have so much at our fingertips and we have so many incredible tools that connect us and our work and our hearts mm-hmm. with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
That to me is mind-boggling, because certainly when I was coming up in conservatory, 35 years ago, whatever it was, we didn't have anything like this. It mm-hmm. was certainly not the way I ever envisioned having a career.
Yeah.
So I think that we can take a lot of responsibility for taking that new piece that has been so beautifully fostered mm-hmm. by an ensemble like yours, Megan, and be able to say, okay, here's the next step. Here's where it goes. We're mm-hmm. all going to sit down with that glass of wine late at night. Or a soda pop if you don't drink wine.
Yeah.
And a cat in your lap, and you know, mm-hmm. you just discover.
Yeah.
Places for it. And then, of course, there are conferences, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Chamber Music America, if they haven't already, they should do a whole seminar either at the conference in January or on their Tuesday series or mm-hmm. something on just this subject that you're bringing up mm-hmm. about how to foster these new works and how to create mm-hmm. funds for them. I mean, you're asking such great questions.
Well, thank you. This
is the kind of thing that CMA, if they haven't already, you know, delved into this or haven't done it recently, I think you should spearhead something with them to...
Well, they do. I know they definitely do a lot of great... They're putting out a ton of content on commissioning
mm-hmm.
and how to do it. And I think that these... And my whole goal right now is that, you know, because I believe very strongly in that the information is out there and you just have to find it mm-hmm. kind of things, mm-hmm. that it's my job to go out there and research about this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm reaching out and talking to people and saying, there is a lot of content that's already happening about the first parts of the commissioning process. And I definitely know, you know, what the standards are for paying composers and, mm-hmm. and those, and then how to kind of build those relationships and things like that. And it's really next steps for me. I'm really concerned about, okay, but what happens after those things? What do I do after that? Because it's not, there's got to be more information than just that.
You know,
when people start building a venture capital fund, they don't just go, okay, well, I got some investors together and let me just put that money in there and we are good to go.
Like,
you know, they, you know, when they're doing that, is that I, and, you know, for all of the negative connotations of putting music and entrepreneurship together in that way, but I like it. So too bad.
But
I really do think of it as like, okay, this is our venture capital fund to say that these are like, these are the activities that we are about to fund in the future. This is the life that I'm about to fund. And I'm going to figure out how to make that happen. That the beginning steps are happening. And then it's like, how do you shepherd one of those funds? How do you make sure that you're creating it in a way that it's going to be around and that I could pass it off to somebody else to continue that work? Making sure that you're creating legacy projects that are going to stand past your, my time singing. That's for sure. Like I, you know, it's not going to last. It's not going to last forever. So, but I do want my influence in bringing more new music to the world, to the, to audiences, to continue after I'm gone, and not just say that I'm setting this up for my own pure benefit of, I want you guys to write music for me.
Right.
And only me.
Well, one of the significant things, in addition to, of course, you know, pounding the pavement for new living ensembles to be doing performances, the other part of this equation that we haven't touched on yet until now is publishing and distribution. And where does that sheet music go? And, you know, increasingly, most, the majority, I would say, of the composers that you would be commissioning are going to be self-published, because increasingly that is becoming the model for any number of reasons, which is a whole nother podcast. And so, what I and a lot of my colleagues try, who are self-publishing, have been doing this a while. What we try to do is spread the word to our colleagues about how distribution works and how to set up distribution deals and how to make sure that their scores are sold not just via them on their website, but from purveyors and retailers all over the world. How does that happen, right? And that is very key to getting a new piece out there in the world with your name in the dedication, right? And you gave birth to this piece, and now with a good distribution deal, the composer can make sure that it's in the hands of potentially, if people pick it off the shelf and buy it, or order the PDFs or whatever they're going to do, that it's in the hands of people all over the world. And that's very powerful.
And you bring up a good point, Alex, that it would be an important next step as I start to think about this, is that it could, I could develop better relationships with publishing and distribution contacts to kind of help that, to say like, these are, you know, we're actively commissioning these composers. I'd like you to know more about their works. Can like, let's make that a pipeline together from that direction as well. Not just the composer having to make those contacts.
That's terrific. I mean, you could, for instance, there's so many of these companies that really love contemporary music. For instance, our friend Christine Clark, who's president of Theodore Front Musical Literature Inc. In Southern California. There's an example of a big distributor, does a lot of stuff all over the world and shows up at a lot of places and gets new scores out there. And someone like Christine and people like her who would be very, very interested, if she's listening, I'm sure she's cracking up right now. I can't believe you're speaking for me. But
Christine, let's talk.
I want to talk to you, too.
Contacting a distributor and saying, I'm going to have a growing number of new pieces, and I would love to have you as among the portals. I would say it would have to be ideally a non-exclusive arrangement. Some of them might want exclusive. The other thing is, in the instrumentation, whatever a trio or a quartet or a soloist is, there are specialty distributors for those instruments, right? There's a place that specializes in vocal music. There's a place that specializes in everything. And so you want to definitely contact those distributors to make sure that they're, that they know that these new pieces are going to be coming down the pike. And I'm pretty certain that they'd say, oh yeah, we're definitely going to want to see them.
Yeah.
So that is a great idea, that it's not just the composer and publisher's responsibility, but it's something where the ensemble can and commissioner can assist as well. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm going to have an episode fairly soon about some of the publishing and distribution stuff, along with an announcement. Megan knows something about this. Megan knows a peripheral thing to this, but my 1 year anniversary show, I already like kind of talked around this, but yeah, there will be some stuff with that on this show. I do want to touch on like some post premiere things that might also be helpful. You know, Megan, you and I have talked a little bit about, like, I've just frankly asked you, is there anyone you can recommend that I should send, like, either this piece to, or I should have look at my music? Like, that's a great post premiere thing to get that piece out there to more people. Like, it may, they may not have the instrumentation right now to do it, but they can, if they like the piece, then it's in their brain and they can be on the lookout for it. Like, that's, I think, one interesting thing. And I had another idea about post-premiere stuff, but I forgot what it was. But I wonder about, going back even further, creating this fund. Ways to kind of creatively, or even some of this, like, one idea is fairly standard, but I don't think we follow through on it a lot. You know...
Ooh, God, sorry. I have a new computer, and now I don't know how any of these things work.
Oh, yeah, everything's all...
Why is my whole life connected?
I know. It's wonderful and annoying at the same time.
Yeah, right? Okay.
But I wonder about, you know, the more of a permanent fixture in your life you want this commissioning fund to be, I think at some point it's going probably going to have to be some... sort of codified. It's going to have to become probably a business, you know, in its own right. Maybe a 501c3, probably a 501c3. And likely, then you can create, like, you can go to, like, your people and say, hey, like, can you give $25 a year? You know, something like, start building that on that level, and build, you know, other performers, ensembles to say, hey, would you like to partner on this? And then they can be contributors to the fund as well, you know, and it can benefit more of a community, right? And make it, you know, obviously you don't want this just to be about you, and that helps to make it not just about you, but about the music and okay, everybody that's a part of this fund, like, you can be a part of what's being created, and becomes a pool.
Yes. Yes. And I'm actively pulling those threads together right now and just kind of getting it started that way. And then kind of all of that, those nuts and bolts, so to speak, is just, I know kind of what that looks like. And then it's a matter of like, actively doing it. So I'm at that point where it's like started it, like have the place and the things for it. And then going, okay, this is how that functions. This is how that is structured. And then doing the like more strategic inviting. So it's not like I'm creating it on the fly as I think of things and then go.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of doing the thinking of things and putting that all into a frame of sorts, and then going, okay, now I can month after month, like, put those pieces together and say like, okay, this is coming from here. This is coming from here. And that's kind of the part that I'm at for my own building of the commissioning fund, so that I'm making that transition now between commissioning people and doing that kind of project to project to a, this is going to become a business arm of itself, or its own entity that is part, you know, in my sphere of Meganina and mezzo soprano, business wise. And it's like, this is its own subsidiary.
That's how I think of a lot of stuff. Like, honestly, if you were to create like a fund that was like, okay, you can donate to this, it's something that I would like, not just because I want you to commission me too, but like, it's something that I would be like, this is doing good work. I'm happy to like donate to that and help to make that happen.
Well, that's nice. Well, and I do worry about that though, because I want to create something where composers would feel connected to this as an entity, where they feel like, I like the work that you're doing, and I don't want it to have any even seemingly like connection to like, if you give to this, then you get money from this. And like, just making sure that you're setting up the information about it in a way that everybody in the field would like to contribute to something like that because they think that it's good work. Mm-hmm. And there is a clear structure for the pipeline of like, if I also want to be commissioned by this, I'd like to give to this, but I'd also like to be commissioned by this. How do those look different? Making sure that that looks like I'm going, oh, this is how I would be considered in this pipeline of things. Mm-hmm. And because you don't want people to feel like it's a pay to play kind of thing.
Exactly. Right.
And absolutely.
And that's like the last thing that I would want, because there's just so much of that in like music world it's like, where it's, oh, you know, oh yeah, you're given this honor, but oh, clearly you've been like donating to this or something the whole time. And you're like, oh, I'm just giving you your own money back. Congratulations.
Yeah.
I would hate that. So it's a lot more of, I do think a lot about, particularly in new music and contemporary chamber music, that I want to get away from us passing the same $50 bill around. Like I want us to get away from just us kind of funding each other's projects and going, okay, how do I get more people that are invested in this because they want to see a world that includes that kind of music, or they want to hear a world that includes that kind of music and be actively involved in it. That doesn't necessarily mean as the performer or composer, but connected to them, tangentially connected, supporting it. There are so many roles, and it's important to flesh that out so that people know, oh yeah, this is for me. It's not just for the person who gets to perform it, or the consortium partners that get to perform it, or the composers that are getting commissioned by it.
Yeah. Sorry, I just had a weird, weird sound in the background.
And it's a very good vision. Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for validating my vision.
And I can't wait to contribute to it. So there.
Yeah.
And I don't care if you commission me.
Winning you over by one.
Exactly.
This is just my like Skype commissioning like mission across across the nation.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I do that all the time. People I know do that all the time. We're constantly supporting projects that obviously have nothing to do with us, but we're supporting them because it's so important to do so. If you're in a position to be able to do so, then I feel it's very, very essential. Support the community. Unity is what we're about.
Yeah, I want to help people keep figuring out how to develop their own audiences, and that goes, you know, audiences that come listen to your performances, but also audiences that just are appreciative of what you do and want to support that work in their community. And that this is one way to also do that. You know, people give of their time, give of their talents, give of their, like their resources. And this is one of those ways in which they can actively support living in that kind of community, whether or not that's like nationally via like social media, or if that's your actual zip code community.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we are at the hour 15 mark, so we're a little long, but that's okay. It's been a good discussion.
It's been a lively conversation.
Yeah. So either of you, last thoughts?
I want to applaud. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say my only thought is composers, talk to me. go back. Composers, let's build a relationship together. That's it. That's all I want.
Exactly.
Alex.
That's right. And that's always my tagline. Dennis has heard me say it so many times, and so have other podcast listeners, that you may think you're in the music-making business, but you're in the relationship-making business, just like what Megan's saying. Everything starts from the smile or the bad pun or the hang after the concert or whatever nice connection that you have with somebody that draws them in to be interested in working with you, whether you're a performer or a composer. I mean, it starts from that. It is very much about relationships. And I just was going to say before that I applaud you, Megan, and any ensemble, any performer that wants to, that is so ardently supportive of and taking the time and the energy to commission new works of art. I think this is exactly what's needed. It's been needed, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's not a new model, but it is a desperately needed one now more than ever. And we have more opportunities now more than ever. So I just want to say thank you for all of your enthusiasm and your great thinking about this very multifaceted subject, Megan. I mean, really.
Well, That's very kind of you. Thank you, Alex.
And thanks to Dennis for, you know, hosting this conversation as a vocalist and a composer, and,
yes,
and a guy who always wears many other hats than that as well.
I like all your hats.
We
so
like
many
all your hats.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Thanks. They're so
a
stylish.
Musical millinery.
Yeah.
There you go. That's awesome.
So many hats. Well, thank you. I'm so glad that you could both do this today. I'm glad to like introduce you and get that relationship jump started. Thank you both for talking today, and Megan, you're a great co-host.
Well, thanks for letting me come on and like be curious about everything.
Yeah, anytime. Anytime.
And thanks for letting me opine.
Yeah,
this was great. Let's do this again, guys.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes,
I look forward to meeting you in person. So
agreed. Yeah. Let's make
something
that
to look forward to.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yay.
So where can we find, Alex, where can we find you online for people who don't remember from last time,
ago? They don't remember, and I can understand why they wouldn't. It's Alex at alexshapiro.org, O-R-G, and also on Facebook. I do post fun things on Facebook here and there, so that's I'm easy to find on Facebook. There are a million Alex Shapiros, but it's one that's kind of obviously me.
There's really only one.
I like it.
And Megan, yep, what about you?
I think you can find me best usually on Twitter. I'm at Mezzo Enen. Mm-hmm. And my last name is spelled I-H-N-E-N. And my website is just meganenen.com. And my blog, which I do a lot of writing and reviewing on, is called The Sybaritic Singer. So sybariticsinger.com.
And you also have
all
one
right
of these little talky-talky things.
What? One, like one of these?
One of these podcasts.
Oh, a podcast.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. My podcast is in hiatus at the moment. It's coming back in this summer. So
Yay.
My
oh,
podcast
great
is called Studio Class. And it's particularly for singers to talk about these kinds of issues and a lot mm-hmm of entrepreneurial type things. Mm-hmm. Just kind of the things that you didn't cover during studio class
mm-hmm
in school.
Yeah. I, as you know, coming at it more as a composer than as a singer, actually, like I'm getting a lot out of, I'm not totally caught up, but I've gotten a lot out of what you've had to say. So
oh,
totally, like, you don't have to be a singer to appreciate and learn from your show. Wanted to give you that
thank
plug.
You. Yeah, thanks.
I just followed you on Twitter.
Yay!
Yay! Yeah. I'm your newest Twitter follower. I'm on Twitter at Alex_Shapiro. Easy.
Fantastic.
With an underscore in between. And
nice.
Yeah, we will all stay in touch.
Absolutely.
So, and we welcome anybody listening to friend or Twitch
yep
us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah, reach out, say hi. I'm
yes
slow to respond to email, as some of you probably know. I'm sorry.
You're faster than a lot of people.
Sometimes.
It's a spectrum.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I'm definitely on the email spectrum.
Well, thank you so much for having us. This has been
oh
great.
Thank you for being here. This has been fantastic. And all of you out in listener land, thank you so much for tuning in again this week, sticking around for year two of this monstrosity. And I didn't prepare a CTA because I have another episode that I have to record in 20 minutes, so I'll try to think of one for then, but you'll hear that next week. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, too, for being here. And as always, I will talk to you next time.
Bye.